UK Wine Show, show number 174. Zork, Closing the Bubbles with David Paul. G'day, it's the 14th of September and welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott and this week we're talking with David Paul from Zork. Zork produces a radical new style of closures and they've just released a new style for closing bubbly wines. In the spotlight, we look at whether your wine has been imported in bulk, and does it matter? And I've swapped a couple of emails with a listener who says he gets tripped up by the mystery gap occasionally, and talk around the office with Jane and Charles says they occasionally find it a bit tricky. So we're going to jump straight into it, and this week we've got our mystery grape variety. This time it's a French grape variety. It's an early budder, flower and ripener, making it prone to spring frosts. But it's able to flourish in regions as cool as the Loire Valley, as well as French regions such as Mâcon and Savoie. Outside France, the grape is chiefly valued in Switzerland, although it's thought to have originated in Côte d'Or, where it was planted extensively in the 14th century. However, these days it's given way to Chardonnay, except for a really small amount that's up there. The wines made from this grape are mostly for drinking quite young, and tend to be light purple with relatively high acidity, low tannins, and aromas of fresh red fruits, often laid with bananas, boiled sweets, and acetone. Hopefully that should give it to you, some of you guys, but I'll give you more clues after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Cheers, Chris. Waitrose is planning to take consumers on organised wine tours in an attempt to educate them about their wine range. The initiative is in conjunction with the John Lewis Partnership's GreenBee.com travel division and will involve six buyers and wine educators who will take groups of up to 20 people to France, Italy and Spain from March 2010 onwards. During the five-day tours, the groups will visit Waitrose wine suppliers and learn about food and wine matching at local restaurants, amongst other things. The retailer will start advertising tours next week at checkouts and in John Lewis department stores.
Sounds like some fun trips. Waitrose has some of the best wines about, and with a bit of customer service, good on them. I imagine they're trying to evangelise some of their customers, and with groups of 20 or more, that sounds like a decent audience for them to do. I suppose if you tell two friends, and they tell two friends, and so on, someone you know is going to land up on one of the trips. What's next, Jane?
Well, the wine writer Hugh Johnson has joined the protest against a new bridge and motorway, which he says will desecrate some of the Mosel's finest vineyards, but he may be too late. Work has already started on the planned High Mosel Bridge, and all appeals against the project have so far been rejected. Opponents held a last chance forum to bring the issue to the attention of the world, with Hugh Johnson in attendance to show his support and urge protesters to continue their fight. Apparently the project will cost around 500 million euros of public money, but will only cut journey times by 30 minutes.
The pictures I've seen of the proposed bridge look like a viaduct, high in the air between two ridges, but with some long, thin foundations. But the size of the bridge is so big that it is a bit of an eyesore. It'll take out some of the vines, not as much as you might think though, since the bridge is high up in the air and not running directly through the vineyards. But I think if I had a vineyard nearby, I'd be upset about the size and how ugly it is, rather than my neighbour losing a couple of acres in vineyard. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, Chris, you know how the world's finest wines are always priced astonishingly high in the best and most expensive restaurants? Well, a top London restaurant could change all that. Bob Ricard is undercutting its competitors by capping the amount it marks up its wines at £50 a bottle. This means the Soho restaurant can offer top wines at a fraction of the price of other restaurants, which can make profits of up to 75% and add hundreds of pounds to the very best wines. Some examples: a 1985 Chateau Haute-Brion Premier Cru Classé from Grave costs £318 at Bob Ricard, but £1,000 at Gordon Ramsay at Claridge's. And a bottle of 1999 Meursault Le Charme Comte Lafond costs £503 at the Greenhouse in Mayfair, but only £175 at Bob Ricard. Its everyday bottles are also said to be cheaper than elsewhere. The owners say £50 is plenty to cover the cost of selecting, sourcing, storing and serving the wines, and that it costs no more to open and store a cheaper bottle of wine than it does a more expensive one. Well, that's it from me this week, but don't forget to visit our website 3050.co.uk to check out these stories.
Cheers, Jane. Bob Ricard's place looks like a great place to have a glass of expensive wine. 50 quid is a bit of a markup and does make selling the wine well worth it. So good on him. I hope it drives more people to come in and try some more of the more expensive wines around. One thing I'd like to add is an unsolicited plug for Hugh Johnson and Jensis Robson's Wine Atlas. It came out in a paperback version last week, and they call it the concise version, but at £20, if you don't have the Atlas, it may be one to have. Of all the atlases I've reviewed so far in the spotlights, this is the best, and I would easily pay £20 just for the maps in there. Wow, I think I should have taken some advertisement money for that, but it does lead nicely into this week's spotlight, which is a rather strange one for us. It's on bulk wine importing. I know you're saying, sounds pretty boring, but you've probably drunk quite a bit of bulk wine in the past. Now, I'm going to update the page on wine and the environment in the podcast section to include some of the notes from this, so do have a look at that. As well as back at show 129, about a year and a half ago now, we interviewed Karen Wilson from Kingsland on this very topic. So here it goes, have a listen to it. This week's spotlight, bulk wine importing. Bulk wine importing is a very unglamorous name for what is essentially a key ingredient in producing cheap, quality wines. Bulk wine is wine that's shipped not in bottle. It can be either cheap unbranded wines or big brands that need to move large amounts of wine. Shipping is usually done in some sort of tank, and there are three issues associated with importing wine in bulk: quality control, environmental issues, and costs. Costs are the reason most of the wine is bulk imported. When shipping wine from overseas, and particularly the New World, such as Australia to the UK, or even America to the UK, there are three options. The wines could be bottled at source and flown over to the UK, bottled at source and packed into a container and shipped, or bottled into a flexible tank, they call them a flexi tank, and put inside a container and shipped, then bottled in the UK. Now, flying wine around the world is both environmentally and economically unacceptable. The only wines that are flown these days are samples for buyers. Bottling at source and packing it into a container is probably the most common way of shipping wine around. The volume of a typical case of 12 bottles of wine is roughly 34 centimetres by 25 by 30 centimetres, or 0.255 metres cubed. That's equivalent to 25.5 litres of volume. But in the case of wine, we only get 9 litres of liquid into that 25.5 litres. So there's a huge waste in the volume when shipping by sea if the wine is pre-bottled. In real life, a standard container can hold between 12 and 13,000 bottles. However, using a standard flexi tank, the equivalent is 32,000 bottles. This is a huge improvement in cost, as most sea freight is calculated by volume shipped, not weight. But it's not just the volume that's being saved. The liquid in a bottle of wine weighs approximately 750 grams, while the bottle can weigh between 300 and 500 grams typically. So the weight of the bottle accounts for between 29 and 40% of the final weight of the bottle of wine. So even shipping by road, where weight as well as volume are key factors, importing by bulk has significant advantages. The key advantage is obviously that more can be shipped for the same cost, which gives them significant improvements in cost. But from an environmental point of view, it can have significant advantages as well. The less shipping means that less CO2 is required. According to the Waste and Resource Action Programme, that's WRAP, shipping a wine from Australia in bulk to the UK versus bottling in Australia saves 137 grams of carbon for a 400 gram bottle. 137 grams may not sound like much, but when you consider Constellation Europe, the owners of the brands Stolz, Echo Falls and Kumala, import 55 million bottles and are getting ready to double this during 2009, it starts to add up. Other large bottlers include Corby Bottlers with 5.4 million 75 centilitre bottles and Kingston Wine and Spirits with 8.3 million bottles that they do for the co-op and 54 million bottles they do for Tesco's. So you can see the volumes here are quite huge. All in all, 199 million bottles of wine were bottled from bulk imports last year. These are big numbers and make a meaningful difference. For Australia, 20% of their wine are bulk imported, saving around 11,000 tonnes of CO2 per year. But according to Rep, they could increase this to 122,000 tons a year by using lightweight bottles and bulk shipping more. Saving your CO2 is not the only benefit. In the UK, where we have no natural use for green glass, importing by bulk reduces the amount of waste glass imported into the UK, as well as providing a use for the glass that's already here. Reducing waste and importing recyclability of green glass in the UK is a good environmental outcome. In many wine circles, though, the idea of bulk importing wine is frowned upon. Wines bulk imported are perceived as cheap, and this is true. Cheap wines, say below £6, is the backbone of the UK wine economy, and these wines have economies of scale to warrant the increased logistics required to achieve the savings. If an artisan is making, say, 20,000 bottles of wine a year, this wouldn't even fill up a flexi tank and wouldn't warrant the extra logistics of bulk importing. In addition, many winemakers worry about importing wines by bulk as they're not there to supervise the bottling and possible loss of quality control. So for expensive wines, it's not acceptable for the producers and it's not economic either. However, there are some advantages to bulk importing from a quality perspective. Wines shipped in bulk have more wine in the tank and as such experience slow thermal changes and less risk from excessive heating as they cut through the equator. Also, wines made for immediate drinking have a short shelf life and as such, bottling closer to the point of drinking mean that the wines are going to be in fresher and in better condition, especially if they're being closed by, say, a plastic cork which has a 6 to 18 month lifespan. Bulk importing also gives shippers the opportunity to adapt the packaging of the wines to respond to the market more quickly. Perhaps modifying a label showing a promotion, or perhaps if they've won an award recently, they can easily put that on the bottle once it arrives in the country, giving them an extra couple of months of leeway in terms of waiting for things to happen. In conclusion, bulk importing a wine is an excellent way of shipping large quantities of wine that make up the low to medium price points. It's cheaper and more environmentally friendly. It also gives greater flexibility for packaging and has some quality improvement issues. Right. Bulk importing, not the most exciting topic in the world, but if you've drank an Aussie wine under fiver, there's a fairly good chance that you've had a wine that's been bulk imported. Did you notice it? No, you didn't. Right, let's give you another clue for our mystery grape now. So here's a big set of clues. Our mystery grape is responsible for Beaujolais. That should pretty much do it for most of you. And although it does pop up in a few other places, it's probably more than any other internationally known grape variety associated with a single wine region and a single wine type. It excels in the rolling hillsides of Haute Beaujolais on the granite-based soils. It is here that the finest wines are produced from the 10 Beaujolais crews, such as Fleury and Morgan. That should be enough to finish off you guys if you're not quite sure what the grape variety is. I'll give you the clue after the interview, which is coming up very next with Dave Paul from Zork on their new Fizz Closure. Let's have a listen to what Dave has to say. Hi, I'm here with Dave Paul from Zork. How are you, Dave?
Mate, I'm great.
We've actually had Zork on there. We had John Brooks on the show about a couple of years ago, actually.
Yep.
Talking about your Zork closure, but you've got a new closure now. What's the story there?
We have. You would have interviewed John at the time we'd launched our still wine closure.
Yep.
And we've developed a really innovative closure for sparkling wine.
Okay. What is it?
Well, it's based on the same concept as Zork, that there's a tear band. So you tear a band and then you simply lift, it pops, you could click it and it reseals. So it's bringing convenience into the hands of consumers.
Okay, the tear band, same sort of thing, so people know if it's been tampered with?
Exactly, it's a tamper evidence band.
Yeah.
That's right.
I'm trying to open one up and let's have a wee listen to it.
Sure, we'll do.
Here.
Yeah. So here I'm just tearing the band off. That's the pop. That's the click. Reseal.
I like the reseal.
You know, all the research we've done around the world, reseal is actually a really important factor because the trend in sparkling wine is to enjoy it every day, a glass every day.
Yep.
And moving a little more toward the consumption away from celebratory. Of course, celebratory is important with sparkling wine, but everyone enjoys a glass of sparkling every day.
Yeah,
so be able to reseal it in the closure itself and put it back in the fridge for later or tomorrow with a different friend is really convenient. It's good.
Sparkling wine, happy drink. So
it's a happy drink. And if there's no pop, there's no fun.
Well, I don't know. I was taught not to pop the fizz. I was taught it had to sound like a nun's fart. Fud is more the word you're looking for than a...
And that's probably the case. To the average consumer, they want to hear that pop.
Yeah, no, it's true. I as a student, I used to shake my bottle of Spumante up and fire the cork as far away as I could. It was good
now,
fun.
You're the type of guy that we're trying to avoid. We're trying to avoid people hurting themselves with those things that come out of the bottle.
Okay, so let's just talk about the closure. The original Zork, the big thing was it had an aluminium disc wedged between two bits of plastic.
That's correct, and that's also the same concept here. The critical factor is that we wanted to maintain a very high level of carbon dioxide retention in the product over years. And a very good way to achieve that is just as screw cap does with a foil. We use the same foil they do in a screw cap, and CO2 doesn't escape.
Yep.
So it does a little bit, but it's not dramatic. In fact, it's exceeding where the wine makers anticipate cork to be over time.
Okay, so the big one was oxygen ingress. You had a small bit of plastic that the oxygen could effectively get through that plastic.
Correct, and that's important in sparkling wine as well. You do want bottle development. Particularly, it does add some really interesting characters. There's not very much oxygen ingress, and it's very, very small, obviously, because the CO2 is such a dominant gas within the headspace. But, you know, all the sensory trials we've done around the world, you can't pick between cork and Zork when it comes to sparkling wine.
What was the reason for developing it? Because cork taint with sparkling wine, I've had the odd corked bottle from sparkling wine, but nowhere near as bad as still wine. So I'm not sure why. Maybe they use better quality corks. Not quite sure exactly the reasons for that. But cork taint in sparkling is a lot less for me anyway than for stills.
You're right, but cork taint is only one of the issues, and there are a couple of factors to it. They do use a much larger cork in sparkling wine, and secondly, because it's carbonated, then it changes the detection of TCA on the palate. So TCA itself isn't as much a critical factor as simple things like convenience, being able to reseal, being able to remove easily. Unfortunately, with cork and the wire muselet, once you remove that wire muselet, you've got a missile ready to go off at any time.
Yep.
And people do get a lot of eye injuries. You know, there's a lot of claims from major wineries around the world, you know, that they have claimed for liability.
So, really?
Oh, yeah.
And the winery gets ticked for the bill?
Absolutely. It's not something that they advertise, but it's certainly a factor. Yeah. But, you know, in their defence, no one knows when a cork's going to eject from the bottle. The great thing about this is that it's in your hand and it won't move until you actually lift up the seal. When you lift the seal, it'll come off in your hand. So you can't injure yourself.
So let's have a look at this seal. Can I just open it up
Absolutely.
Here?
Absolutely.
Let me just see if I can...
Put it off. Here you go.
All right, so it's made up of two parts, isn't it? Is it two parts?
It's technically four parts. It has an outer cap.
Yep.
It has an inner collet, and the collet have little fingers that grip around the top of the bottle.
Yep.
And then there's the internal foil, and then there's a seal, which is specially designed for a positive seal inside the core of the bottle.
Okay, all right. So there's this wee gold thing. Is it always going to be gold in your product?
No, you can, because it's plastic, and have it absolutely any colour you want.
All right. Yeah. Well, there's in our one, there's a wee gold thing that's got the wee hooks on it, and that goes on the top.
That's correct.
It pushes over the lip of the bottle.
That's right, the crown seal of the bottle.
Is that a normal...
Yes, it is. We designed this to fit a standard bottle. There are three standard bottle finishes around the world, and we've designed this to fit each one.
Oh, I didn't know there was three different bottle finishes.
Oh, there's a few more than that, but...
Yeah, okay, there's three of the main ones. So and that clips over there, and then when you push press it down, that's pushing those wee hooks under the hook of the glass, really.
That's correct.
Under the lid of the glass.
And once the cap is down, which you're going to do now, once the cap is down, those little hooks can't come out, so they're locked in.
Yep, yep.
And so that will now go to full pressure. In fact, it takes 12 bar, 1,200 kPa.
Yep.
And you won't get a champagne even at 12 bar, maybe 10, but not 12.
Yeah, I've got a carver that I taste regularly, and it's fairly is lethal. All right. So can you get it off with one finger? Can you get it off? Yep, you can.
There you go. And, of course, the same on reverse. Now, the great thing is that you can leave this in your kitchen drawer after you finish this bottle and use it on another bottle. You know where it's really...
That's because I pay a lot for champagne stoppers. I've got a load of champagne stoppers.
Which leak gas very easily.
Do they?
Over a period of time, absolutely.
Is this better than a champagne stopper?
Oh, yeah, because it's got the foil internally.
They've got plastic. But to be honest, champagne stoppers for me, they're...
Well, you know where it makes
24 hours is like the longest that they'd go.
That's true. But if you're on premise, if you're running a restaurant or a bar and you have a house sparkling, you want that sparkling to have gas, not just today or tomorrow, but maybe 3 or 4 days' time. And the beauty of this is that you will have gas 3 or 4 days' time. So you won't lose as much if you're in restaurant or bar. You, in fact, one of the major wineries in Australia is looking at it just for that reason.
Is there a way of gassing this up? Because one of the things is that as the bottle level drops, you've got to lose more carbon dioxide out of the wine to get the pressure up so that the carbon dioxide doesn't come out of the wine. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, of course.
So if you've got a third of a bottle, it's not going to help you that much, is it?
Because it's temperature related. So if it's the cooler it is, the less gas escapes into the headspace. So, you know, if it's really cool, it'll maintain a good deal of gas pressure.
Okay, I have had bottles of fizz where I've opened them up, left them on the side, come back to them sort of 12, 20 hours later, and they've still been quite fizzy.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just because you open a bottle of sparkling, it doesn't mean it loses all of its gas.
Okay. So who do you think are the main markets for this product?
Well, you know, globally, the largest market is Europe. So we're in the process of strategically releasing Zork in the European market.
And the UK is one of the biggest consumers of fizz.
UK. You know,
we are the biggest consumer importer.
And the great thing about the UK is that they've moved forward in terms of screw cap. Screw cap broke all the rules in terms of tradition. In some ways, sparkling wine, champagne in particular, have been very, very traditional. What we've found in markets like Australia is that because everyone enjoys a glass of sparkling on a daily basis, that, you know, moving away toward the tradition, the tradition of sparkling into more everyday consumption will mean that convenience is very important. And the UK consumer understands convenience. Screwcap delivers it. Zork delivers it as well.
Okay. All right. No, it sounds good. I actually quite like it as an idea. I did like the Zork as well, but I still haven't seen a lot of Zorks around in the UK market. How is the still wine closure going?
Well, it's got its feet in the ground, definitely in markets within Europe and also the US, particularly the US. But, you know, there's a lot of different products for still wine. There are very, very few products for sparkling wine. And so this Zork will actually accelerate in terms of take-up because of a number of factors. But, you know, we actually do have a lot of brands, but mostly in the US market and through Europe.
How does the product compete on price? Because the Zork, the original Zork, was an expensive closure by plastic cork closure standards. Mainly, I imagine, because it's, you know, three parts, it's got to be welded together, all that sort of stuff. So how does this compete on price? Do you have a sort of a general price point for this?
Sure we do, yeah. But let me come back to the standard Zork, you know, the standard, the still wine Zork. You know, there are lots of different motor cars on the road. You don't necessarily buy the cheapest. Some deliver better value and better benefits as you get more expensive. This one actually delivers, the sparkling wine closure delivers a lot of benefit. And from a winemaker's perspective, it's really easy because it's just simply push it on with existing equipment. You don't have to put a cork in, and there's problems with cork. If it dries out, it smashes bottles, and you don't have to put the wire on, so it's very efficient. So your efficiency will pick up. We're launching this on the market for about the same price as cork and muselet, so no one's disadvantaged. The big advantage from the winery's perspective is because it's a really modern package, you can leave it without the traditional foil hood, and of course there's cost savings with that.
Although the foil hood was added by dodgy champagne producers to hide how much was in the bottle.
Well, it's actually tamper evidence.
It is tamper evidence now as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
But you can never get a normal cork back in there. So.
Well, that's exactly right. But you know, the foil has become a traditional mark of you know, sparkling wine. Not so much in Australia. Australia, they're certainly in the popular price category, is moving away from foil into, you know, a more avant-garde, a more modern label style. And you'll see that trend globally. I was in Germany last week, saw the same trend happening in Prosecco. Very modern labels now, aiming at a different consumer set than they were 5 and 10 years ago. Oh, the other thing is, that of course, that it's 100% recyclable.
Is it? Even with it, by separating the aluminium from the plastic?
Some areas need it separated and they can separate it. Mostly they don't.
Really?
Mm-hmm. It's a recycle code 4. So, you know, it's covered within the general plastics and materials generally.
Even though the aluminium's there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some markets in the world require separation, others don't.
Okay, that's interesting. I know my local council are rubbish with recycling plastic. They're good with glass, but they're rubbish with plastic. So, all right. Excellent. All right then, Dave, we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
I really like the Zork closure. I've been using a couple of the Zork fizz stoppers to keep my bubbly in good condition. Because let's face it, you buy a bottle, you get the free champagne stopper effectively. Now, apart from being a bit harder to get an off and on than a normal champagne stopper, they work fine. Obviously, things like oxygen ingress is always going to be an issue, as well as gas escaping through the thin lip of plastic that's in there between the metal liners. But this should be much better than natural cork, so hopefully no more old bottles of flat fizz. I do like this closure, and the fact that it's resealing is useful. I like it probably more than using a Zork for still wines, which I don't think really gives any benefits over screw cap. For me, the Zork closure is the best innovation on fizz closure I've seen for a while, so definitely if you see one, give it a go. Now I've got one more interview looking at closures, this time Vino Locks, but I'll give you that after a break for a while. I know these closures and bulk importing can be a wee bit dry for some people. So next week we're going to be returning to my trip I did from Old Blighty going through to Central Italy, and next week we're going to be stopping off at Barolo. In fact, we're going to spend a couple of weeks in Barolo. I spent a time in the region talking with Enrico Rivetto, based in the crazy hills of Barolo. Those hills are crazy. I'd bought a TomTom GPS system to guide me around Europe. As you may recall, about a year and a half ago, I went down to Barcelona and drove up to Rioja, and it did my head in driving around all those areas. So I got myself a GPS, and it was doing really well until it got to those hills in Barolo, and it just became unstuck. It kept trying to send me up between rows of vineyards and saying, this is a motorway. But never mind. And thank goodness I only got a few dents on the car. And thank goodness for a four-wheel drive. So they did get me out of trouble. Anyway, we'll talk to Enrico next week. Almost finished for another week. But before we finish up with the mystery grape, as I said at the beginning, I swapped a couple of emails with Stevie in Burgundy last week. Stevie says he served his internship at a winery located in the Haute-Côte de Nuits, so the recent podcast with Oliver Gard caught his attention. In the interview, we talked about the soils being less deep versus lower vineyards, and the climate is cooler, and the combination results in less structured wines that are more easy drinking and fruity. And Stevie typically agrees with this, particularly concerning the cooler climate, and he thinks the wines of the Haute-Côte de Nuits are excellent quality factor for cost ratio. But he did want to point out that the soil depth varies completely on where one is, and certain wine growers, such as Chateau de Villers-Fontaine, where he served his internship, has deeper soils and produce massively structured wines, both red and white, with huge depth and aromatic complexity. Chateau de Villers-Fontaine niche is traditional Burgundian wines, which is designed for long and productive aging, such that red wines begin to open up after about 10 years, which is pretty good going for Pinot. So, Haute-Côte de Nuits, cool climates, generally thin soils perhaps, but some areas where it's a bit deeper and getting a bit more complexity in the wine. Thanks, Stevie. He did mention in the show that he likes the news, and he does like the mystery grape as well, although he said he gets dumped from time to time, which causes him to do a bit of research on the old Wikipedia to get a better idea of what was going on. Now, if you've got any feedback from the shows, drop me an email. I especially like comments, good and bad, about the show, because it helps work out what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong. Right, thanks very much, Stevie. Now, we're just going to finish up with this week's mystery grape variety. And as you recall, the mystery grape was Gamay. Let's have a listen to the clues again. Gamay is a grape responsible for Beaujolais, and although it does pop up in a few other places, it's probably more than any other internationally known grape variety associated with a single region and a single wine type. Officially called Gamay Nord Justbank, it's an early budder, flower, and ripener, making it prone to spring frost. But it is also able to flourish in regions as cool as much of the Loire, as well as other French regions such as Mâcon and Savoie. Outside Beaujolais, the grape is chiefly valued in Switzerland. Gamay may well have originated further north than its main home, in the Côte d'Or, where it was planted extensively in the 14th century. However, these days it's given way to Chardonnay by just a small amount. Gamay wines, most of which are for young drinking, tend to be light purple with relatively high acidity, low tannins, and an aroma of freshly picked red fruits, often layered with bananas and boiled sweets and acetone, which often result from carbonic maceration. That's where the wines ferment within the skins without any oxygen nearby. Gamay excels on the rolling hillsides of Haute Beaujolais on the granite-based soils, and it's here that the finest wines from the 10 Beaujolais crews, such as Florian Morgan, exist. Right, that's it for the mystery grape. just to finish up with the quote. This time it's from another poet. I know, we're getting a few of these. It's good for me though, because I'm not an English major, so I'm learning the names of some famous poets around. This guy's called William Butler Yeats. He lived in 1865 to 1939, and according to Wikipedia, he's a pillar of both British and Irish literary establishments. I'd never heard of him, but I'm from New Zealand. All right, so here's the quote. Wine comes in the mouth, and love comes in the eye. That's all we shall know for truth before we grow old and die. And until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.